What are your thoughts on marketing hype versus facts, expectation versus reality? What's the most outrageous claim you all have made in life that ended up being 100% bullshit?
Ooh.
I mean, most of them.
Butterscotch
shenanigans. Buddy, welcome to episode 322 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and my neck is twisty.
I'm Sam, and my wrist is healing.
Ooh. And this is a show where we talk about life, body parts, and working in the games industry. Today is July 29th, 2021. Dunk on everyone. Before we get started, we have a warning. There's going to be swears and profanity in this show of the positive kind, but it's in there. So get ready. We'd also like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. You went there, and we grabbed your money. Thanks for that.
Yep, that did happen.
Good. We liked it. We took it. It's ours now. Let's talk about something. Black Summer. It's like a show.
Yeah.
On Netflix.
Yeah, every so often we give like a rec for some, you know, thing to go check out. So if you like zombies and the fast, very spooky kind, I recently randomly, for some reason, the Netflix algorithm got me and showed me this title called Black Summer. And I was like, huh, okay, you know, zombies, sure. I'm feeling a little horror element here. I'm going to go for it. And so I've been watching it and actually finished both seasons in the last like 2 weeks or so. So it like really, really took off. And I think the fun part about these zombies, again, it's a very gruesome show. So you got to be, you know, go to it knowing that if that's your cup of tea, if it's not your cup of tea, do not participate. It is not a good rec in that case because it goes all the way. But importantly, two things. One, the zombies are the kind that basically you don't need to get bitten. It's just anytime anyone dies, literally within 5 seconds, they're zombified. And like fast, terrifying zombies, right? Who are just like unstoppable.
So it's like 28 days later zombies because they also take like 30 seconds.
Yeah. And what it basically explores then is sort of like you start in this, like the other piece is in the structure of the show, which is done with the little vignettes. Essentially, like a lot of them are actually what like single shot scenes that are so well done that I'm aware of how ridiculously effective this camera work is, like while it's happening. Because it'll do just like one really long shot for like 3 to 5 minutes. And that's like a little vignette. And then it closes and then it'll jump to a different character or something like that. And so oftentimes by the time one episode ends, you see almost like the same situation, but from a couple different people's angles, as far as like what was going down and what people were involved and that sort of thing. So it's got a very fun structure to it that you don't see or haven't seen in shows that much, which I think is kind of worth exploring. And that paired then with the speed of those zombies like turning, they basically explore the extent to which that fact makes people's attachment to each other like really odd. Like in the first season, of course, there's a lot of hand wringing about like, oh my God, so-and-so's about to die. Like, oh no, we have to, like someone has to literally, you know, kill them, like shoot them in the head so they don't come back in 10 seconds and kill all of us. And then by the time the second season rolls around, it's like, it's basically months into this whole thing now. And everyone's just hard as steel. Yeah, as soon as someone like breaks their leg or something, literally someone just like
everybody just pulls out their gun, like here we go.
Yeah, and the craziest one is like watching gunfights go down between sort of like groups of people, because as soon as guns like shots are being fired, then people are also having to keep tabs on the zombies that are now literally animating. Yeah,
their own side.
Yeah, and so it's just like it's a level of like frenzied wildness that I haven't seen portrayed quite as well. And the character is really good. So it's very fun. It's very gruesome for people who are into that sort of thing. And I'd recommend it. Also, I watched it on 1.5 speed, which you could do in Netflix.
So maybe the zombies weren't fast.
Yeah. maybe the gunfights weren't as hectic as they seemed to be.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I guess the reason it worked.
Why did you watch it on 1.5?
Because speed? The tension. That's weird. There's too much tension in the, like it's too much. And so like, instead of having to just sit there for literally like an extra, you know, minute sometimes while really creepy shit is happening and you're like waiting for the bad thing to show up, you get there a lot sooner, this is never a thing I've actually, like a technique I've used because I usually can't watch horror movies and stuff. But for some reason it actually made it like palatable because the tension didn't get drawn out. So I wasn't just like fully ratcheted up for so long. So that's like a weird thing about it that I found for myself. And I don't know if you guys have done that before, but like it worked very well. So yeah.
I have a hard time. I at some point, I think Sam, you had recommended listening to podcasts on faster speed. And I had tried that, but I found that I have a hard time paying attention to things verbally at normal speed. And then if it's sped up, because if my mind wanders for a second, you know, then I've missed even more stuff than I did before, and I'm way off track. And so I found myself rewinding, and it took me longer to get through the podcast.
Interesting.
With that. So you're saying that in this show, that I assume this is an apocalypse scenario, because every zombie show is an apocalypse scenario. But that kind of made me think, it'd be kind of interesting to have a show where basically the fact that people become zombies when they die has just always been true. And society
so you're now has, like a far future society where like there is a society and it's not an apocalypse anymore, but
it's like, what would the like cultural implications of that be? And what would like what would the religions of the world be at that, in that kind of a place, right? Because like people would still just be doing their normal day-to-day lives. They'd be going to their jobs. They'd be like farming or going to work, like whatever. And everything would be running as normal, but then there would be this kind of undertone where like death is viewed like way differently.
Yeah, because it's gonna come get you.
Yeah.
I think that's what's fun about that second season, because it shifts into more of that. Like the first one's all about like people versus zombies. And then the second one is actually like a really heavy mix of just people versus people, given the fact that once you kill a person, they turn into a zombie. It's actually sort of like what's happening in second season.
If there's one thing you can trust about people, they will continue to be horrible to each other. No matter what.
I mean, yeah, that's sort of like – that's what basically the second
season. Yeah. Every one of these shows is the same thing, right? It's just like, oh, we got to deal with the world against like us. It's now us, the whole world, you know, coming together for this thing. And then literally like a year in or whatever, they're just like, oh, wait, we hate each other though, right? Forgot about that.
Actually, yeah, let's keep on murdering each other.
Yeah, but that's why shows like Parks and Rec or The Good Place or like Ted Lasso or whatever. Like,
speaking,
because those shows they don't have that, right? Those shows are just like, hey, here's some people who are all they have their flaws, but they are trying to be good, and they're like they're working together for stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think, you know, it's just so much more. It's so much nicer. It to watch.
Yeah, Ted Lasso season 2 started. I haven't watched any of it because I think my wife wants to wait until it's like out so we can just kind of watch the whole thing, you know.
That's where I'm at.
So yeah, so we're now rewatching the first one, which my wife has already done a few times, I believe. But for me, it's the second watch through, and it is just such a good fucking show. It is so good.
I will say,
and there was stuff that I read differently the first time that now, like upon second viewing, like some of the character behavior, some of the things that they say and stuff, like it now has a completely different read on it. I'm like, oh shit, like they, like there are these moments that you think a character is doing one thing, like something really, you know, in that context, but then you realize there's just this other layer there, you know, of like a thing that seems to be bad, or seems to be somebody like losing control, is actually them like demonstrating to somebody else that they are stronger than they thought they were, you know, and like this kind of shit, you know, like it's just so good. So
it's a good show.
Yeah. We basically binged the first season though. So over again. So now we'll be back waiting,
I
guess.
I feel like Ted Lasso is a good sort of wreck on the other side of this, on the scale.
Right.
Yeah. Like the Black Summer situation, opposite. Ted Lasso, take your pick, you know?
Yeah. When it comes to just like, brutal sort of things, I watched Gunpowder Milkshake, which is also Netflix, a movie. It's I guess Assassin's Guild kind of a deal thing, you know, like it's basically John Wick.
Yeah.
And not, lighter might not even be accurate. It's just like another John Wick, just with different characters, sort of a sort of thing. But I won't say anything else besides I loved it. Apparently it's got pretty mixed reviews about people largely picking on like the fighting feeling gratuitous, I think is the main thing.
That's one of those ones.
It's like John Wick, you know?
I watched this Assassin's Guild movie and there's just too much fighting.
But it's very fun. And then in particular, so I'll just mention, I'll briefly describe without any detail, probably my favorite scene, so that you'll kind of know it's coming, but you won't really know. you know,
thread that needle,
which is our imagine that your arms are paralyzed, right? But you still need to fight, right? and so you manage to get some weapons attached to your hands, right? But your arms are paralyzed. So what are you going to do to then fight, right? Because if your answer is spin around and whip your arms around really hard to say to get them into arms, the air.
Or are they just biological the flails at this point?
They become biological flails. And so
what?
That's a whole thing. So basically once that moment, like I was already in it anyway, because it was very fun. But once we got to that moment, and then a lot of things happen with that sort of core premise. And it was just so over the top and absurd and hilarious.
Is Daniel Radcliffe in this? Because it sounds like a Daniel Radcliffe type of
that
situation.
That moment is like has that vibe. Which if you've seen that movie, Guns Akimbo, that is some wild, wild shit. I can't even say I recommend it, except it was so over the top and absurd that maybe you do have to watch it, you know?
Like I did watch the one where he was dead.
Wild.
He's been in a lot of weird shit. I don't know what Daniel's up to, but I'm here for it. You know, I'm showing up.
Yep.
He got all of his like pop culture cravings out of the way by the time he was in his like mid-20s, where he's like, I've done that part of my career, being super popular, being in movies that everybody watches, making lots of money. I've done that part now. Now I'm going to be a farting corpse in a movie that nobody watches. Yep. This Guns Akimbo. What he's got like guns like nailed to his hands.
Yeah, it's part of a reality TV show, like an underground illegal reality TV show, where they just pit two people against each other, and then whoever wins gets to be alive still and gets money, right? And so that's the underlying thing. And then he doesn't intentionally get, you know, mixed into this, but then he does. And then
he's got guns nailed to his hands.
Yeah. And a lot.
So anyway, that's what I was wondering. Cause like, as you're describing this, I'm like, I mean, this is a Daniel Radcliffe fight.
Yeah. If you take that movie and then join it to John Wick, then that's basically what this one is. So
it's good. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, let's talk about some studio stuff. So I want to have a CEO update.
CEO.
A letter from the CEO.
Or we'll call it.
How's it going?
How's it going? Here's the segment title. View from the top.
Ooh. Oh.
Huh? That's pretty good.
That's nice.
Well, so just for some quick refresher, a few weeks ago, we made Adam stop doing so much web programming. We said, we need somebody to zoom out and sort of make their focus working on the company and whatever that entails.
Yeah.
Because it hasn't really been anybody's specific job before.
Somebody who's ultimately responsible basically for everything instead of having diffuse responsibility for all of the things. So I think I don't have really like a structured set of thoughts on this because I've been having millions of thoughts over the past 2 weeks. And so I think the main things have been that transitioning from doing largely programming or at least, you know, deep thought work related to that, to now having to kind of keep track of and figure out what is happening, and try to figure out how to like document that stuff and then be able to think about it and figure out what is this? Is this good? Right. When there's a million of these things, has been that's been the difficult part of the shift because the transition from like focused work where I can hyper focus on it to here's a million things, right, has been the main challenge. It's been doable because of ADHD meds, so you know, thanks for that, whoever invented
thanks Adderall. Drugs.
Yep. So it's been manageable and it has been fun. But it is interesting as you start to dig, because as anybody out there who's ever suddenly realized, oh, hey, I haven't like looked deeply into this facet of my life, whatever it is. Right. And as you start to dig, you're just like, holy shit, there's a lot in here. And you just keep on
going.
There's
some layers.
And there's like bones are coming out and like, you know, and then you hit lava at some point, you know, there's just like so much going on in there because you just kind of just left it and didn't pay attention. Right. And that's basically what it feels like. Kind of working through how the company works. You know, why are we doing the things that we're doing? What are people doing? Like none of it is just like bad or doesn't make sense, but all of it's just, it's not designed, right? So it's all fairly came to be organically in a way that kind of got the job done. And a lot of that was because we didn't know what the job was we were doing, right? And so we didn't really understand, we didn't have the full picture of the problems, and therefore we couldn't have really precise, concrete, carefully designed solutions. And so everything's just a little fuzzy.
So as far as like so, where you've gotten it to in the last 2 weeks, then kind of what, where, I guess, if you could pick like a thing that has been either a takeaway or a thing that now we're doing that we weren't doing before.
I'll start from the same overall idea, mm-hmm. which is, I'll start from the thing that led to the realization, actually, probably is better. Did we talk about the problems board already last week or previously?
Yes.
We did, right?
Pretty sure.
I think we did. So as I mentioned last week, we put together basically a bug tracker, but for things that are not software bugs, things that are bugs with the studio, right? With things that happen as you're doing stuff or don't happen that should have. And part of this is includes a template of like, okay, kind of fill out this exercise, trying to nail down the details of what that was so that people can now collaborate with you and help you figure out what's going on, what to do about it, et cetera. So the big takeaway there was that, first of all, that's really hard. But second of all, the thing that makes it so hard is that we are all solutions focused, not problems focused, right? Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is, in the process of identifying and solving some issue, right, the first thing you do is identify the problem, right? And the next thing you do is, given that problem, try to come up with a list of things you can do and evaluate those, et cetera. So the problem is that we automatically are searching for solutions just in our brains as like problems come up, right? And so very quickly, something that we identify as a problem of some sort we're already thinking of it in terms of often a specific solution. But even when not then, it's, you know, some myriad like fuzzy idea of like, here's all the ways we might deal with this, right? Mm-hmm. And so everyone is jumping right into solving the problem. The problem with this though is that how good your solution is depends on how well you've defined and identified the problem, right? Which is, I mean, it's an obvious thing to say, but it's like it's deeply fundamental true in an important way that is really hard for people who like to get stuff done to really like truly feel, because we're biased towards working on solutions. And then when it comes to collaborations, if we bias our presentation of some issue that we're having towards a solution that we're thinking of, we also trap all of our collaborators in the same mindset where even if they start offering different solutions, they've all sort of
– they're in one shoot,
implicitly, right? Unintentionally agreed that the problem was correct, mm-hmm. right? And when I say correct, I don't mean like you can have the wrong problem. I mean when you're breaking a problem apart, it's always – there's always a lot more there than you think, because what you experience when you identify a problem is a symptom of the problem, right? And a symptom is always going to come from some – you know, some process not working the way you want or whatever. But everything that results in the symptom or set of symptoms itself is composed of a whole bunch of moving parts, right? It's not, there's not just a thing there. It's not just like, oh, this didn't work. It's not a thing, right? It's always, oh, well, this thing is composed of all of these parts, right? In order for all of it to work collectively successfully, each one of these parts has to make this happen, that happen, that happen. It all has to happen flawlessly, blah, 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 right? And as you start to break apart and more specifically convert this like general idea of a problem into these really specific components, then that basically is root cause analysis, right? That's you identifying the real reasons why the thing is happening. But also in the process of doing it, you now have revealed all of the things that can be addressed with solutions. And there isn't one thing. Yeah. There's a whole bunch of things. Solution. They kind of imply their own solutions, because usually the thing is like, once you really break it down, now the statement of the problem implies the solution, right? Because you're like, oh, well, one of the reasons this didn't happen was because this kind of handoff can get missed by the person who's supposed to receive it, right? So you're like, oh, okay, well, that's very specific. How do we address that thing?
Yeah, I think to kind of put this into sort of like a concrete like example, it would be kind of like if I said, just as a simple one, if I said, hey guys, I haven't been feeling too good, so I'm going to start working out 5 days a week.
Yeah.
Okay. So like I've described what I see as a problem and I've described a solution. So here's the part where it gets tricky. I've actually announced two things. Okay. And yeah. The last thing I said was the solution. So for you to then say, oh, why are you feeling so bad? You now have to ignore the most recent thing I said and throw it off to the side and go back and talk about the first thing I said, which actually kind of goes against your nature, mm-hmm. right? So instead, if I said like, hey, I haven't been feeling too good. I'm going to start working out 5 days a week. You might say like, oh, are you going to lift? You're going to run? Yeah. Like you'll just ask me some questions about my workout plan, mm-hmm. right? As opposed to saying, why aren't you feeling good? Like, have you been sleeping well? What about your food? Yeah. You know, because also there's a rejection aspect to it. Because if I've already announced what I want the solution to be, and you start digging into more stuff about the problem, then it can be taken as an implication that I haven't thought through the problem well enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, right? and it's also true, right? But not in a judgy way, right?
No, yeah. But yeah. I could take it in a judgy way, yeah, right? I could take it as an affront on my ability to reason about the problem. Mm-hmm. And also because I'm the one who announced the problem, I believe that I'm the one most familiar with the problem. And so if somebody comes in and asks me a bunch of questions about it, then I may think like, you know, I've already thought through these things, even though I may not have. yeah. So there's a lot of interpersonal sort of angles to this idea of getting at root causes of problems because of the solutions focused angle of it. That makes it, like you were saying, it makes it very difficult socially, a very difficult thing to practice.
Well, I think the bigger problem, I think even more than the true implication that you haven't thought through all the aspects of the problem, right, the implication that's not true, but that is still a default inference, right, is that you're wrong about there being a problem,
yeah,
right? Right. Because people interpret this other people trying to figure out how to nail down, isolate, and find the root causes, and plural, the root causes of the problem, as basically some way of attacking the idea that the problem exists at all.
Well, in some ways, right? It can be like sort of turning what was a localized, what feels like a localized problem that you can solve quickly. Having someone dig into the systemic background of it can be very annoying if you're actually trying to get that thing resolved relatively quickly, right? Because it doesn't pay you any dividends to go work on like a 3-month project to solve the problem, you know, writ large, that's actually behind all these things in a way that actually solves kind of the acute pain that you're experiencing with regard to like whatever that weird sort of symptom set was, right? That you're kind of dealing with.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is that bias towards solutions and being solutions focused mm-hmm. makes it so that you're slapping band-aids on stuff always, because what you're actually doing is treating a symptom. It's the same deal as when you feel bad and you go like exercise, right? It's that will often help because exercise is good for you, right? And there are these other things that happen, right? But you don't know why you feel bad, right? And so if you're very lucky, it's literally because you haven't exercised.
You just picked the one right
thing. But that's incredibly unlikely, right? It's in all likelihood, there's 100 things going on in your life and how you treat your body and how other people do and how you treat your mind and how other people do and so on that collectively have put you into the state that you're in, right? And there's nothing wrong with like fixing something, right? The problem is that you can so easily go down the wrong path, and even when you don't, it's usually the case once you like really get down and break the problem apart that there's some really high leverage shit in there, like some stuff where it's like, oh, like this little tiny thing, right? If literally we just stopped doing that, or if literally somebody sent a message when this thing happened or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. All of a sudden a huge swath of potential problems go away, and it dramatically reduces or removes the symptoms too, right? And so the problem with being solutions focused is that not only are you usually solving the wrong problem in the first place, it's that you're expending a lot of resources when you could have expended a lot less and gotten a better
outcome.
Often just articulating the problem and like really figuring it out is actually just makes it so it's solved now, right?
Yeah. And I think this is sort of the thing I want to tap into here, because one of the benefits we've had, I think, with the Bounty Board so far, the Problems Board, has been actually the slowness of it. And because what's required is like, if you see a problem or you experience a problem, you go in there, you kind of like, you know, type up your, you know, here's what happened sort of a thing, right? And then over the course of actually a couple of days, then you but you put your little kind of spiel together and then you invite other people to kind of weigh in on the problem, right? So it's a whole team effort. And you can invite people multiple times as you're kind of like, you know, resurfacing, refiguring out the problem. And one of the most interesting pieces of that has been, I think in the past, one, again, because we have, you know, the general ADHD bent of the three of us means that you do have a bit of that like shiny object thing going on where it's like, ooh, like here's this problem I just experienced right now. I'm going to go like 100% dive in and fix just it.
Drop everything.
Right. Yep.
Go solve it.
And
put a bandaid on it immediately.
Right. Yeah. And so what I think what can happen there, and this actually I think happened with that one thing that Seth and I were working on this morning, which is that you can solve that sort of like that bandaid or that sort of like the acute pain of it. But if you solve it so fast, then you may not necessarily actually see what that underlying structure is that's actually generating that first.
Because the end result of you putting a Band-Aid on, right, is that if it sufficiently covers the symptoms, then you actually hid the problem instead of fixing it, right? And this,
yeah,
this is happening constantly, right? And this is what I've been constantly trying to say to the team. Because it's not a thing that you can just like naturally do. I can't do it either. Nobody can, right? Where the idea of if something is going well, that's also a signal that there's something that's not going well that's hidden that you don't know about, right? If something is going poorly, that's a really easy signal that something is going wrong. Sure. You should go look at it, right? But the reality is that everything is inefficient and partially broken at best all the time, right? There's no like – everything is perfect and works and could not be improved and is not actually causing dramatic consequences state you can get into, right? Because if you think about it in terms of waste, it gets a lot easier. Well, I guess waste and cost benefit, right? So even if you are not bothered by a thing that you're doing and it is getting done and it's correct most of the time, right? You being then content and being fine and being like, okay, well, this is fine. There's nothing wrong with this, right? Means that if it was the case that if you dug in there and discovered, holy shit, a robot could do all of this, or oh wow, actually this was causing these negative things I didn't even realize because the overall experience was so positive, right?
Or not necessarily because the experience is positive, but because you are a more resilient person,
or right? Because that's it too.
And you aren't just bothered by things,
right? Depending on your thresholds, right? Because like me having ADHD. I get bored instantly if something is tedious, just instantly. Right? So I have like my threshold is in the basement for that kind of thing, right? But other people are just like, oh yeah, like I'm going to crush this, and they're focusing on the fact that they can crush it, right?
Mm-hmm. And they'll just grind through it.
And they'll just grind through it, and it doesn't bug them at all. And so because of that difference in tolerance for things not being ideal. Again, the ideal doesn't exist, but you know, getting closer to that, then people end up seeing different problems and seeing mm-hmm. them in different ways. And that particularly insidious one is the one where somebody doesn't notice there's a problem because their tolerance for things not being really effective is really high, right? And this is also going to be one of the things that creates conflicts within a team, right? Where it's easy to feel like, oh, this person just doesn't care about whatever, right? They don't care about.
Or likewise, it's easy to feel like this person needs to like shut up about this and just deal with it. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's the flip side. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
both of those things could be true.
Yeah. But actually the underlying reality though is just that the nature of work is that it is largely invisible and can always be improved if you dig into it, whether or not you specifically are having a bad or good time with it, right? And so that's been very interesting. And then there was one other big – so that was the big kind of like discovery, I guess. This was from reviewing the board and seeing how people were tackling problems and what people got focused on as they started to have these asynchronous visible conversations. Like this was visible. That's why we could see it, right? Mm-hmm. Because it was all happening in like the comments field of these cards, right? And so like I could just go look at it and see what did it look like when people tackled this problem, right? So that was very cool. The other big thing that I kind of knew, but I've been able to, but I knew it as a general problem that has now become specific, which is that our communications channels, how we get information to each other, are really noisy and really mixed in the sense that different kinds of information that require a person to take different kinds of action are all in the same place, right? So like in Discord, we might be seeing messages about two people communicating with something about some project they're trying to do. And you also may see like somebody post a thing, oh, hey, like this is happening later today. Make sure everybody's here for that or whatever, right? You may also see, oh, shit, something is on fire. Everybody drop everything and come do this, right? Similarly, like in our Favreau board, they have their own little alert system. You might see alerts for somebody pinged you because they need something urgently on a card to get information, right? Or it could be somebody mentioned you, which causes the alert, right? Because their card was buried somewhere and they didn't want to deal with throwing it into your pile, and they just knew that you could get to that thing if you just popped up an alert, right? Yep. And so now all of a sudden, you as the person seeing all of this, right? You don't know what is or isn't urgent, what is or isn't important. And because there's urgent stuff and important stuff in there, you have to treat all of it as if it's both urgent and important, right?
Well, at the very least, you've got to look at it now.
Yeah, you got to look at it. That's what I mean. Yeah,
and then figure out.
Yeah, because you actually have to start with the assumption that you need to know what that is.
It's like the Schrodinger's urgency. Like everything is urgent and non-urgent until you've looked at it.
And that was the other thing that I think led to the very early – this is something like these very early, very easy kinds of fixes where you just say, oh, okay. So like alerts in Favreau now. Like never can be urgent. If you need something urgently, you got to do it somewhere else, because now people get to interpret in the Favreau board, oh, an alert is just somebody trying to pull me into something, right? Just trying to say, hey, I want you over here at your earliest convenience, right? And then similar deal with in Discord. It's kind of restructured a bit, put some rules in there. That can be very, very easy, right? And now all of a sudden the channels of communication get unmixed. And so when you get an alert or when you get a message at all, then ideally, there's a whole category of ways you get messages where you just know, I don't have to worry about this until later, right? And this other one channel where like the things that you need to deal with this very moment come in, right? Which are actually almost nothing. And that was the thing I noticed too, is that everybody on the team was treating so much stuff as urgent, just like so much stuff everywhere. And that was causing a sort of general sense of people not having control, right? And not having time.
Feeling like really if you start working on something, you might have to just drop it.
Yeah, because you never know what's going to happen. Right.
Because some new – well, and this – and I think you're right about the communication channels where if there's a – it's like having a pager. You know, like back in the day when like doctors would have a pager when they're on call, you know, and it's like that's the only thing that it's for. And so if your phone rings, if other things happen, it's like, meh. Mm-hmm. But when your pager goes off, you're like, shit, somebody's trying to die. I gotta go deal with this. So having a singular communication channel that is for urgent stuff, and every other thing can be dealt with at your earliest convenience, as you said.
Ideally when you're planning your work. And so, if you're doing work in like plans on the order of a day, right? Then that's perfect, because like there's almost nothing no piece of work that lands on your plate right now, you know, that can't wait until tomorrow, you know, there's just almost nothing. And so if that's the default, is you just say, okay, like every day I'll like make my plan for the day, I'll like get my inbox figured out, get everything prioritized so I know what order I'm going to do stuff in. And then that's what's happening unless something truly actually urgent happens, which has to mean it's like on fire. Something is on the line for real. Right. But outside of that, I was like, no, just make your plan and do it, you know? Those are the two very high level things that I have so far. There's a million other things.
Those
are the big ones.
We'll hit some more next week.
It's all
pretty interesting. I think this idea of getting out of the work and working on the work, I think is pretty important. There's that book, the E-Myth, which I think we talked about a long time ago.
Yeah, years ago, we basically found all of those books and read all of them. Right?
Yeah, and it's a theme that we've talked about before. But this idea that it's incredibly challenging to be an employee and a boss at the same time.
Yeah,
right. Your incentives are mixed. Your attention is split. You're kind of, by definition, you're half-assing two things, right?
Yep.
And so I'm sure, we'll have just more and more kind of interesting things coming.
Since you noted that, I think an interesting point about that problem is when you're an employee and a boss, right? Because the rest of your of your team is going to be treating you as a boss, right? Then there's an implicit assumption there that if you say something, then that's true, right? Or, and I don't mean like true in the global capital T, as in like, if you say like, oh, I need to get this done. Yeah, that's what's happening now. Yeah. If you say, oh, here's what I need, here's the solution I need you to take care of, right? Oh, like, oh, I identify this problem, right? Whatever. Then there's this built-in default where the assumption is that all of that part of the work is already done in terms of like identifying the problem, clarifying it, understanding exactly what the things are, looking at the possible solutions with that really good, well laid out set of problems and so on, right? And so that was one of the consequences of this, of the fact that we were our own bosses and our own employees and everybody else's bosses and everybody else's collaborative teammates, right, all at the same time, was that so much of the stuff that was going on in the studio was basically inefficient out of the gate because we didn't take the time to like really figure out what needed to happen because we were busy trying to do our other stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But the assumption was that we had, right? Which made sense. Like, I mean, nobody did anything wrong here, right? This is just like, that's just the inevitable outcome of something like this.
We were operating in the structural environment that we had created for ourselves, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Yep.
Pretty interesting pivot. All right, let's get on to some questions.
Okay.
Heist, upvoted. Oh, sorry. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. Got to make sure I plugged the link. Heist, upvoted question comes from Tiger Shark Bassist, which is a pretty good name.
Sure, yeah.
Who says, if you guys were to guess Flux's favorite type of music, what genre would it be? She seems like a pretty fun, funky space trucker. Mm. I would love to hear her Spotify playlist.
Well, I've been thinking.
I assume Polari beatboxing.
Yeah. I think you basically, you take like a, well, actually, weirdly enough, this is sort of like one of those questions that you try to answer when you're coming up with the music scape for the next game in some ways, right? Because it's like, okay, when you say, okay, this is like a fun galactic trucker of some, a funky galactic trucker of some sort. I think it speaks to like trying to musically pull the feel of this particular person or character into the world, right? So weirdly enough, I've thought about this a lot. And it kind of actually is along those lines, which is along these beats of like some mix of interesting acoustic stuff with then essentially more beats. So the Tatum's Polari beats thing, which to me kind of ends up feeling something like, I love the vibe of like, I feel like lo-fi hip hop, if you're traveling through space, just driving around in a big space truck is like a dope scene. And then kind of like some of that just like kind of dirty guitar stuff, country guitar is just so good.
Yeah. She would also probably need a lot of music that can kind of go on, you know, and doesn't draw attention to itself in the more, you know, subtle kind of a way. And so that, because like you're on a spaceship on the long haul, right? Doing a lot of just like manual work, building things, fixing things, right? You gotta have your mind sort of pleasantly occupied at all times while also not being distracted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You don't want vocals for starters. None of it has vocals. It's just atmospheric background music, you know. But
unless it's alien language you don't understand, and that's fine.
Yeah, well, it's got a good sort of variation because sometimes you're in that kind of contemplative, like just chilling out, you know, being relaxed. Sometimes if you're having a bit of a rough day and you need to kind of get some pep in your step, you need something that slaps.
Yep.
You know.
Yep.
But it's all pretty funky. It's kind of like a bluegrass EDM beatboxing sort of.
I assume there must also be mixture. There must also be some sort of I don't know, like getting into the death metal territory in preparation for fighting. You know, bosses feels like the wrong word in the context of lore. You know, but it's the right video game term anyway. But when you are taking on these.
Challenging
foes, right? And you gotta get prepped because you always get prepped, you know, where you're making all your potions and you're getting your blades sharpened.
Interesting question is like, what music would you listen to before like a light speed jump? You know what I mean? Because like that particular kind of a situation feels like something where you have to be playing some particular song.
I think it depends on how how in the universe, in the lore, mm-hmm. you know, it depends on how trivial or non-trivial.
Yes, and, that's what I was going to say.
And frequent and then dangerous, you know, it is, right? Because if it's non-trivial and dangerous, right, then this could mm-hmm. be just your last moment, right? So that's a different sort of a thing than if you're just like, whatever, you don't even notice. Just barely registered that it happened, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. Actually, do we have FTL in our universe?
We've got teleportation. We've got wormholes. Yeah, yeah. We got all kinds of stuff.
But we don't have like ships that like have FTL drives.
We have like the derp, for example, from Levelhead, the intergalactic railgun thing. It's essentially
ships.
No, shoots packages. Yeah. But presumably it's just a ship is just a package full of people. Really?
Yeah.
When you get down.
But they're really heavy, though.
I mean, you have to go faster than light to have any kind of semblance of even interstellar delivery, you know? Like, imagine ordering something from the Bureau of Shipping, and they're like, it'll be there in 73 years because you are 73 light years away from us. Like, you've got any space-based lore must have some form of faster.
Yeah, but the question of whether it's in a ship or whether it's like mm-hmm. the ship has to go somewhere or whatever, right? And to like get into a wormhole makes a big difference, you know. Mm-hmm. Here's a question.
Well, there's a variety of ways you can do it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's wormholes, there's faster than light travel.
We got to figure out there's lots of tech. That's sort of usually where we go with these things.
So, I feel like the derp is pretty much along the
line. Well, so with the derp though, right? Because the derp is trying to shoot things super fast, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the main problem you're going to have with the derp is just the energy cost of getting something up to that speed, right? Because of course, the closer mm-hmm. you get to light speed, the more and more costly it gets, like exponentially, to move a piece of mass faster, right? So the reason that light gets away with this is because it's massless. So here's the question. Mm-hmm. Is the package made out of light? Is it a hard light?
Yeah. So this is where we've been going with this stuff is exploring the concept of hard light, which are one of the materials that's in Levelhead, which are these – they're just blocks to turn off and on. But we had to answer the question like, how the fuck would that happen? And so we were like, mm-hmm. well, I mean
– it's hard light.
If it was light but hard and you could stand on it, then you're good to go.
So if it has no mass because it's light but it's hard, so it like mm-hmm. – right? Then now all of a sudden you can construct ships. You can construct packages.
Massless.
And now those parts are massless things, mm-hmm. right? And
so, I mean this is what a lightsaber is, right? I mean, mm-hmm. The idea that you could have like just a beam of light that goes out 2 feet and then stops, you know, like come on. Mm-hmm. It's magic at that point, which is where we're leaning into.
Yeah.
Except it won't burn you and you can stand on it. It's
hard.
It's just hard light.
It's not hot. It's just hard.
I mean, you could probably heat it up, you know.
Probably. Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. So there you go. There's Flux's music choice. Next mm-hmm. question comes from Alan MB, who says, so I got a PS5 a couple months ago. Well, most of the hype and claims from Sony were highly exaggerated. The haptic feedback on the controller lives up to the hype 100% and is the best improvement to me.
Yeah, that's the most important part of any $700 console, I think we can all agree.
Is the slight vibrations that you feel in your hands.
Yeah. Your hands. Yeah.
What are your thoughts on marketing hype versus facts, expectation versus reality? What's the most outrageous claim you all have made in life that ended up being 100% bullshit?
Ooh.
I mean, most of them.
Made right.
Yeah, most of them. I think the thing that runs you into trouble here is the fact that people don't understand things. So when you're communicating about a sophisticated product, something like a PlayStation 5, you don't actually get to communicate about the things that are really the most important about the product. So for example, if it's the case that this thing uses like solid-state drives – which actually means like a lot of really, really important things for the kinds of games that can be developed, the way in which the experience of the machine is had.
How fast the loading times are.
Yeah, like all these things are actually far more important usually than like the extra haptic feedback, which also I've heard is just like dope because you can like pull back bows and stuff. Like it just apparently feels amazing. So much so that Xbox was like, yeah, we're going to probably do that with our next controller, which is always a good sign. But yeah, so like – Not to say that is not literally worth buying a console for, because it is. Like, I think that's the whole thing, is that any one of these little innovations is. It's the challenge when it comes to marketing is not in depicting a reality, but it's in depicting what you'd call it, a truth, which is like a capital T truth, which is like
the essence of an experience.
Yes. How do I convey to you what it is like to engage with this machine? There's a reason why, like in the case of PlayStation, that thing looks like a fucking sci-fi box that sort of just like got drop-shipped in from orbit. There's a reason it looks like that, because the what the team's trying to do is to communicate to you how sophisticated and like sleek and like just good, right?
How futuristic
this box, like this thing is. And you have to do that at every single layer. And so when you get into some of these claims about like what the thing can do and all this other stuff, all of them are, if the marketing team's doing their job well, which obviously Sony's did, they're going to be trying to kind of line up along some particular like capital truth here about how they want you to experience this thing. And the problem is that you don't really get to pick, I guess is the weird part, as a marketing team, like you don't get to pick which one works. You could pick
which experience people actually can grok and then is compelling.
Yes. And so things that are very easy to communicate may not be the most important thing at all about the product, about the experience. It may even in some ways like associate it with things that kind of belie like other stuff that like doesn't actually come and like show up at all. But importantly, it's like it's literally not even remotely about that. It's about like what particular thing about this product, about this game, whatever else, can I communicate that actually lets you get excited about it? So in the case of like, we talk about Ark quite a bit, because simply saying the line like you can ride dinosaurs is enough to oftentimes get people to be like, I kind of want to check out this game, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what we talk about when we talk about a hook. It's actually that. And the hooks oftentimes aren't the most important part of the game. They're just about like getting your attention, and being able to figure out what that is for any product is really fucking hard, because oftentimes it's not what you thought it was.
Yeah. Well, for any product, this is true, but in particular for ones that have really complex ways of interacting, so like a video game console, you know, which not only is how you interact with it, but how you interact with every game that is available on it, right? And that is also true of a game. It's as soon as you get into it's true already. I think my favorite one that I've ever seen out in the wild of a weird marketing claim was a giant like person-sized ad thing at a Target a few years ago that was for some razor, and it was like, now with a metal blade for up to 100% more control.
Mm-hmm.
You mean right? Metal handle?
Metal handle, see. Sorry. Yeah. Metal handle, sorry. Yeah. A metal handle, sorry. For up to 100% more control, right? Okay. Unpack that. That means nothing. Yep. It means literally nothing. It's a metal handle. It doesn't do anything. It's a thing you hold
on
to.
As if when I was shaving with a plastic handle, I was like, oh, I'm out of control. I'm just wildly whipping this thing around.
Well, what they wanted to do is they want to give you the sense of like, because like using a physical item that's like hefty, right? Mm-hmm. And feels well crafted.
Feels better.
Feels good. That's a good, it's like saying like a mechanical keyboard hitting, slapping those heavy keys, right? That feels good, right? But it's not necessarily doing anything. And you can't, it doesn't work just to say like, oh, this metal handle like will make you feel
it
like
it just feels better to
like
you.
It's better, right? Yeah. So they're trying to get at that truth.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I was thinking about it.
But in a way that they feel
drive.
Like a person will actually like somehow respond to, because you can't convey the actual experience. And especially for a complex thing, there are so many experiences that are had that even if you just tried to pick one and accurately convey it, right, that would still be insufficient, because your experience of the thing is not, oh, at this moment in time, this happened and this is how I would describe my experience, right? Your experience is your entire recollection of the emotional impact of interacting with this thing, right? Mm-hmm. That's what you're trying to capture when it comes to marketing. You're trying to pick the overall like sense of what it feels like to be a person who plays World of Warcraft, whatever, right? You're trying to convey that sense, but you cannot do it by like picking a moment out of the game that is an actual experience, a momentary experience, and trying to accurately transpose that into marketing. Right.
Yep.
Well, and even more interesting with this is when you're talking about something like a solid state drive, to me, that is the biggest jump for this current generation of consoles.
Yep.
But the problem is it is nothing. It's the lack of an annoyance that used to be there. Yep. Right. And you can't sell someone an emotionally resonant message about like, hey, you're not going to be annoyed by this thing anymore, which.
But you're still focusing on the consequence, because the reason that like you know that an SSD is like that's the big jump is because of what it means for this technology to do its job, right? And one of the things that it has to do is move data from one source to another so that you can interact with it, right? Yeah. And that's a slow process if you have worse hardware, right? And so the SSD like jacks up that process like to 10,000x or whatever, right? Like it's a huge, huge amount. But you can't tell people that because, of course, any one of those little pieces that you try to tell them, like they have to have so much context to grok it. Even if they do, you didn't actually describe an experience. You described some information that you're hoping will cause them to remember an experience and then now think about the opposite of that, right?
I think this is the reason why I think Sony's relationship with indies who are not developing visuals on a AAA scale has been so confused and continues to be confused. Yep. Because indies who are not making games that are visually stunning, I mean, literally PlayStation's phrase was what greatness awaits, right? Mm-hmm. Like their whole pitch is like, you can be like inhabiting these literal like other worlds that people have built and they look like the world that you are in. Like it's just sort of an unreal situation. It's like they're transporting you. Yeah. And so this doesn't square well actually with games in general that are made not at like that AAA quality budget, which I think is why, you know, they just haven't been able to care as much, I think, about the indie sphere because it doesn't actually line up with the capital truth that's behind the console in the first place. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Is it on brand for you to like play Stardew Valley on your PlayStation 5?
Yeah.
You know?
Literally. Yeah. It feels weird to even say it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course you can. You're going to have a great time doing it, but it doesn't fit into
I assume it's on there. I don't know if it is.
But it's probably everywhere, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because like you said, it's the marketing is it's all about that fidelity. So that is kind of confusing.
Yeah, it has to be dishonest to be honest, right? Is the thing. Mm-hmm. But because that's true, then you're always writing this line of does your dishonesty convey the truth, right? Because that's a really, really hard needle to thread. And if you miss the mark and it just feels like now it's just untruth, so that's it, because you didn't capture the truth with the lies, right?
And a good example of that is all the No Man's Sky stuff we've talked about.
Yeah, that's the best example of it.
Yeah, so as far as picking one that like my favorite missed mark to me, but again, like it didn't miss at all, importantly, when it comes to like that game selling successfully and like nailing its audience and stuff. That was a perfect tagline. But in terms of like overpromising, which was this whole every atom procedural. There aren't any fucking atoms in the game. Like again, if you want to get down to like what the difference between marketing and dev is, like that's the difference in that statement, right?
But also if you think about the stuff that people were so angry about, right, when it comes to that game, at least in my recollection, it was all specifics. It was all like, oh, you said that this would be like literally true and this would be literally true, right? Mm-hmm. And while people were, when they actually got the game and played it, they were like, oh, well, like this proceduralness isn't like actually as interesting as I hoped it would be, right? That was actually one of like it was a complaint, but it wasn't the one people were up in arms about, right? Because that core lie of every atom procedural, right, was a marketing message of what it meant to feel like experiencing this game, which is that it's all about seeing stuff you've never seen before, right? Mm-hmm. And so much of it you won't be able to believe it, right? And they actually got close enough to that even at launch. That wasn't the main complaint, right? Mm-hmm. The main complaints were a million other things where they got specific, right? Where they told the truth that became a lie because they said, like, we are going to literally do this thing. Like,
well, they got too close to reality. They
got too close to reality. And so you can get hurt in both ways, right? If the truth is too concrete, if the lie is too concrete,
yes,
when attempting to get at a truth, right, mm-hmm. then you're much more dangerous territory. I think that's a lot of what happened to them is they had a lot of marketing happening for a long time, right? Mm-hmm. And the messages that they were putting out were all over the place in this space of like how specific
There's implications about features that they ended up getting about features.
Well, it wasn't even just that. It was they would just always say yes. If somebody said like, can you do this in the game? They'd be like, yep, you can. Because I remember they never announced multiplayer. They just answered people's questions about multiplayer by saying, oh yeah, sure, yep, you can do that. but if you looked at the features list of the game at launch, they didn't mention multiplayer anywhere. And so then, of course, like players bought the game expecting all these features. None of them were in there. And also, I think at some point they thought like some of these things they could just get away with, because I remember their multiplayer answer was like, well, technically you could play with other players, but the universe is so big that it will be impossible to find other players. So of course, on the first day of launch, two people go to the exact same place to see each other, and they can't see each other. and so they got caught, you know. So yeah, you got to be careful. Yeah, marketing is always lies, but you're trying to lie to get at the truth. But if you're lying about a lie, then that's where it's a problem.
Yeah, because the thing is, like, I think using the word lie is a weird one, because all it is, it's abstractions that get far enough away from the ground to really try to point at what the overall like experience is supposed to be.
You
really
need to
frame the overall thing, right?
You need to frame what the emotional experience is going to be, and you can't do that by just like listing specs.
It has a solid state drive. How you feel about that?
Yeah, it has a solid state drive, which is fast, right? Instead, you would like show a commercial of like somebody sitting in a chair, turn on their PlayStation 5, and then suddenly like they're in a wormhole, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like load speeds up to 30,000 times faster.
Even with something like that though, right, which is hard to convey, like there are some things, no matter how important they are, you cannot successfully convey, right? And in marketing materials.
Actually, so the haptic nature of that controller is one of the interesting ones.
Yeah, you can't convey that. Yeah, and you can't convey increased loading times, right? Because how do you do that? Well, you would have to actually convey, you'd have to show like a side-by-side of a thing loading and slow in this case and fast in this case, right? How fucking boring is that? That's not
– Yeah, again, now you're marketing on a feature comparison rather than like the higher level thing.
Not on an actual experience, right? Yeah. And then if you didn't actually draw attention to that, and just showed somebody getting right into a game or whatever, like that's what you expect, right? So it's actually, as Seth said, it's the absence of something that is there, and you can't – so like you can take – this is actually one of the things, the traps that we've fallen into with our past games is identifying the stuff that like really mattered in terms of the actual experience, but then realizing belatedly that we couldn't actually market that. Yeah. There wasn't a way, right? And then you're like, well, shit, this is the thing that differentiated the game, like made it what it is.
You can't tell people about it.
And there's no way to market that. There's no way to make people care without having the experience first. So yeah, it's a dangerous,
brutal
territory to be in.
Yeah, we're probably not the people to ask about how to market things.
No. I definitely know how it works now after having failed at it so many times, but that doesn't make me feel remotely confident about being able to do it correctly.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's a tough game, marketing. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Koster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, just go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to the Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the archives. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.